Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Christine Fair, who's a professor in the Centre for Peace and Security Studies within Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. She's also a senior fellow at the Counterterrorism Centre at West Point and previously served as a political officer to the United Nations Assistance Mission to Afghanistan in Kabul and as a senior research associate at the United States Institute for Peace's Centre for Conflict Analysis and Prevention. She recently returned from Pakistan, where it appears there is a coup in the making. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And just this week, Prime Minister Yusuf Gilani was forced to appear before the Pakistan Supreme Court, where facing contempt proceedings because he's covering up for the president's in his struggle to remain immune from prosecution for his apparent. Well, he was caught, the president was referred to as Mr. 10%. So there's probably a little fire there where all that smoke is. So my understanding is that Pakistan is sort of, the policy of Pakistan have turned into a soap opera.
Yeah, so actually the issue of the contempt charges is a little more complicated. Back in 2007, when President Musharraf was definitely showing himself to have been a check that had been cashed at least thrice, yet the Bush administration wasn't willing to let go of him. They wanted to find some way of laundering him through Benazir Bhutto's then electoral legitimacy. So working with the United States, the Musharraf government put this piece of legislation through called the National Reconciliation Order. And the NRO, as it's called in Pakistan, essentially dropped a bunch of corruption charges against Benazir, several people associated with Benazir Bhutto's Pakistan's People Party. And it was very carefully worded and dated such that her primary rival, Nawaz Sharif, and his party, the Pakistan Muslim League, would not be exempted from their various criminal charges. And with that NRO in place, Benazir Bhutto returned to Pakistan, and she was planning on contesting the elections. And then, of course, she was assassinated, and her husband became the president. The Supreme Court of Pakistan, the Supreme Court justice who had been ousted by President Musharraf, was very much opposed to this National Reconciliation Order. And for this purpose, President Zardari didn't want to reinstate that justice because he knew that he would immediately vacate the NRO, putting all of those charges back into place, and also rendering the qualifications to stand for elections by various PPP officials in abeyance. And, of course, that's exactly what happened when the Supreme Court justice was reinstated. Actually, in 2009, he vacated the NRO, said it was illegal, and all the charges had to be reinstated. But nothing happened for 2 years, in part because the army was intervening and encouraging the court to sort of lay low, because if they were to bring down this government, there was no meaningful alternative. But what's happened in the last year is that the army has been able to buttress the political fortunes of Imran Khan. And so what we're seeing now is the Supreme Court is being very aggressive in revisiting the vacating of the NRO in their efforts to try to bring down this government, because they now have this blue-eyed boy in his King's Party waiting in the wings.
And Imran Khan, of course, is a famous cricket star who previously had no serious political base, but he's had massive public rallies, generating huge crowds.
All in the last 9 months. For years, since like the 1990s, when he returned to Pakistan and began recuperating from being this, you know, Lothario lover boy cricketer to being a serious politician, it was a joke. But in the last 9 months, we've seen a number of turncoat politicians leaving their various political parties and flocking to him. And remember, you know, Pakistan's a parliamentary democracy, right? So it's not like in the U.S. where people vote for a president, i.e. a person. The person can be a Democrat or Republican, and it has nothing to do with what happens with the congressional turnout. In Pakistan, you become prime minister when your party, either by itself or in coalition, takes a majority of the seats in the parliament. So what's important in watching Imran Khan's fortunes change is that he's being able to bring into his party a bunch of well-established politicians, many of whom are religious leaders, for example, who literally have millions of followers that translate into millions of votes. And that's how Imran Khan is going to prevail is not on his own, on the forcefulness of his own personality, because that's not how you become the prime minister. Becoming the president of Pakistan is even harder because it's an indirect election of an electoral college made of the Senate, the National Assembly, and the provincial assemblies. So I think what we're going to see is Imran Khan bringing as many turncoat politicians. In fact, a friend of mine calls the PTI, which is his party, the Pakistan turncoat industry. And we're also going to see other parties like the ethnic party / mafioso movement, the MQM, as well as smaller parties with the encouragement of Pakistan's intelligence agencies, flocking to him to form a coalition that might be viable. The army doesn't want anyone to come in with a strong coalition, right? They want a weak coalition that they can continue to manipulate and undermine should the political actors get out of line. But I think that's what we're looking at. I think that's the game plan of the Khakis.
So again,
or khakis, as Americans would say.
Again, I'm speaking with Christine Fair, professor at the Georgetown Center for Peace and Security Studies, and also a senior fellow at the Counterterrorism Center at West Point, recently back from Pakistan. Just though to go back to the roots of the political turmoil, recent political turmoil, in October, the Financial Times published an article by this peculiar Pakistani businessman Mansoor Ejaz, claiming an anonymous memo that was written after the bin Laden raid, asking for U.S. help to curb the army, and then that resulted in November, the U.S. envoy, Pakistan's envoy to the U.S., Hussein Haqqani, had to resign after claims that he and President Zardari wrote this memo, which they both denied, and then the army chief dismissed coup rumors. After Prime Minister Gilani speaks out in December about an alleged coup plot, and then just after Christmas, the Pakistan Supreme Court opens the inquiry into the memo gate issue, and then just a week or so ago, the army publicly rebukes the Prime Minister after he criticized army leaders in an interview, and he responds by sacking Pakistan's defense secretary. So I guess that's the sort of key points in the soap opera, right?
Well, and of course, don't forget, you left my favorite part out. So the only witness linking Hussein Haqqani, who is also at the heart of this, who is a former ambassador to the United States from Pakistan, Ejaz Mansoor says that Hussein Haqqani actually drafted that memo that he then delivered on Hussein Haqqani's behalf to Admiral Mullen. There have been BlackBerry messages leaked and so forth, but there's no evidence other than the claims of Ejaz Mansoor that Hussein Haqqani authored that memo. Now, I'm not saying that Hussein did not. I'm simply saying there is no forensic evidence making that link, only the claims of Mr. Ejaz Mansoor. Now, the star witness of this, again, Ejaz Mansoor, most recently surfaced in, I kid you not, because you can't make this up because it's Pakistan, appeared in a music video wherein female wrestlers were competing nude, in which Mr. Ejaz Mansoor was providing the commentary upon the pugilistas' performance in the ring.
And this, of course, before a Eurotrash audience who were cheering and booing the women writhed naked in the ring.
Absolutely.
With Mansoor Ejaz providing a blow-by-blow commentary.
My favorite was, it's Double D and Nasty Nasty. Double D is the world-reigning champion. Boy, she's really giving it to Nasty Nasty. Hey, Frank, this is really some expletive-deleted tumbling action. this is an outrage. And, of course, the other claim that Mr. Mansoor Ejaz made, or Ejaz Mansoor made, is that the head of Pakistan's intelligence organization, General Pasha, traveled to the Gulf to get permission to sack President Zardari. Now, what's very interesting, and this sort of shows the degree to which the Supreme Court of Pakistan is in the army's pocket and the degree to which it's so politicized, they have only taken up one set of the accusations of this obviously credible witness, the nude wrestling commentator, Ejaz Mansoor. They've only taken up the assertions that Haqqani was involved in writing this memo. But what's been very disappointing in the Pakistani media is that no one has had the scrittle fortitude to simply say, well, so what if Susana Connie wrote this memo? It isn't treason. It is not treason to ask a foreign power to assist the civilian government in forestalling a coup. It's not treasonous to, in fact, ask a foreign power to buttress the constitutional order, which does assert civilian control over the military. Conversely, under Article 6 of Pakistan's constitution, it is most certainly treasonous for an intelligence chief to seek permission in effort to sack the president. Yet the Supreme Court is only dilating upon the most farcical of the claims that Hussein Haqqani did this and that this is somehow treason. So even if you took Mansour Ajaz to be anything but a lunatic goofball of no credibility,
Tremendous self-promoter and blowhard. I used to interview him until I thought he was totally full of it.
Well, you should bring him back on. And the question
that's true.
That I have is like,
we could get some nude wrestlers in here in the station.
How did you secure that spot? I think, for example, I should like to get my husband a spot in such a video.
Right.
I think my husband would enjoy that for our anniversary because, after all, you'll recall that he defended his participation in that music video, saying that he did this because of his wife, to please his wife. How thoughtful.
Right. Well, meanwhile, though, but just on a more serious vein, Haqqani himself, who apparently is a very talented man and highly respected, the former Pakistan's former ambassador to Washington, he's living under house arrest in the prime minister's residence, saying he fears for his life.
Yeah, I actually had the chance to meet with Ambassador Haqqani. He is definitely living in a gilded cage. After I met with him, some ISI goons followed. Well, I don't want to say they followed me. It was immediately after meeting Haqqani that I had another meeting in a very public place with a colleague, and the ISI came and interrogated not only my colleague, but also his young son, who I think is like nine. I'm really bad at aging kids, like circa 9 years old. And I got an email about the visit from the so-called farm boys. So obviously just seeing Hussein Haqqani was a problem for these ISI goons who felt the need to not only intimidate my associate, but also the child of his associate, just utterly, you know, outrageous intimidation tactics. But a couple of problems with this legal proceeding, and this is something peculiar to Pakistan and Pakistan's interventionist Supreme Court, is that technically no charges have been filed against Hussein Haqqani. What the Supreme Court was considering was a petition filed by the PPP's principal nemesis, Nawaz Sharif, saying that the memo violated fundamental human rights of Pakistanis. And so what the Supreme Court was ruling upon was whether or not Nawaz Sharif's petition is maintainable. Now, there are two implications of this, which is sort of like inside baseball, but it's important to understand in terms of placing this drama within the larger context. One, the Pakistan Muslim League's Nawaz Sharif was one of the chief supporters of the Supreme Court justice. So they have an alliance that's now gone back, coming up on 4 years. So this is not nonpartisan. The second issue pertaining to this is that none of the so-called evidence presented to the court arguing that Hussein Haqqani was involved in this memo has to be forensically validated or subjected to custodial chains of evidence. So
I'm just going to say, Chris, I'm sorry that we've actually run out of time here. I don't mean to interrupt you, but...
Oh, so let me just say briefly, what this means is that any manner of nonsense can be entered into the court record, and then this fuels Pakistan's jingoistic press, which encourages nut jobs to take vigilante action against Hussein Haqqani. This is a very perilous situation for Pakistan's democracy, but also for Hussein Haqqani himself.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. She's a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point and serves as a political officer in the United Nations Assistant Mission in Afghanistan. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began talking with the Quinnipiac pollster down in Florida, Peter Brown, who's in charge of the Florida polls for Quinnipiac, and to try and get a sense of the landscape ahead as this very important Republican primary begins, with Newt Gingrich coming out of South Carolina on a roll. But it's apparently a much less right-wing state than South Carolina. Probably there's not too many states more right-wing than South Carolina. So Peter Brown didn't think that Gingrich is going to do that well. He's already disadvantaged by an enormous, about 200,000 absentee ballots that have already been mailed in, mostly for, it's assumed, for Romney, who's been blanketing the states with television. But he did was open to the possibility that that this thing could go all the way to the convention, which of course is in Florida, in Tampa. Didn't think the immigration aspect was going to play much down there, even though I suspect otherwise. I think Gingrich's less hostile attitude to immigrants will probably resonate with the young Cuban American voters down there. But by and large, he felt that it was really a big media state that requires lots of money. And unless Gingrich is real clever, as he's proven to be by getting free publicity, it's probably going to go to Romney. Then I talked about Romney's, the source of the wealth of Bain Capital apparently comes from the oligarchical families in El Salvador, one of whom was linked to the death squads. So that's something to look further into. And Justin Elliott has dug this up at Salon.com. He has an article, The Roots of Bain Capital in El Salvador Civil War. Of course, there's a lot more to be looking into in terms of Romney. And it's pretty amazing that, as Romney himself mentioned, his father was not even born in the United States, which, of course, he ran for president, which is contrast with the insanity surrounding Obama's fake birth certificate and his alleged ties to the Kenyan Mau Mau. Then I spoke with Chris Fair, who really does know more about Pakistan than any other person I can find. She's just back from Pakistan, where there's a coup underway. The military are going to put in this cricket star as a front man with a weak coalition so they can manipulate the situation, which they have been doing from day one. But she also talked about this amazing soap opera going on involving the guy that created this political scandal involved with a couple of women in mud wrestling. It's all too bizarre. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. A lady dressed in white with a man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck. A shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right. Another headline written down. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.